Welcome to the Insightful Investor Podcast, a weekly series that seeks to share industry, investment, and market insights. We define insights as concepts that are counterintuitive, widely misunderstood, or underappreciated. In other words, unique ideas that you probably won't hear elsewhere. I'm Alex Shahidi, the host of the podcast and co-CIO of Evoke Advisors, one of the nation's leading investment advisory firms. Learn more about our show at insightfulinvestor.org. I'm excited about today's episode. We have Fran Kanaire here from Vanguard. Fran, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Fran, you've been at Vanguard for 26 years, and currently you're the principal and head of Vanguard Investment Advisory Research Center. I know previously you were global head of private investments, and then also before that, global head of portfolio construction. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
Thank you very much. Me too.
Why don't we just kick it off with your background and what led you to Vanguard?
Sure. As early as I can remember, Alex, I was interested in investing, which is unusual because my family doesn't really have a deep history. My mom was a medical research scientist and my dad was a school teacher, but just got the bug in high school. And that led me to Drexel University. Drexel was one of the few colleges that had a co-op program and within a track of portfolio management. A lot of finance schools were classical finance and they had a portfolio management track. So I went to Drexel and it's a five-year program with the co-op and just really loved everything there. Graduated 6 months after the 87 crash. So jobs in investment, Wall Street type jobs were hard to come by. So I had to take a little detour and did distressed lending for 2 years while going to business school. And so that was a great experience because, doing distressed lending is a lot of forensic accounting, really understanding the balance sheet and the income statement, and going to business school at night. The markets had settled down. My goal was to find a way back to the asset management business. And after getting my business graduate degree, I ended up at a multi-family office, executive investment advisors, $1 billion under management, three founders, all CFAs, left Wall Street and started their own advisory experience. So I had a great, great time there, 6 years. And as we see today, the industry going through aggregation, integration, and roll-ups, they ended up going through a roll-up. And I had about a year to decide if I was going to stay at the new firm, but it would require a move to the Midwest. But I had a year to kind of explore what I wanted to do and just was so lucky that I happened to see a job opening in Vanguard's personal advisory services. They were just starting advice at the time. Vanguard was a direct investor up until that point, and they were entering into the advice business. So I was able to get in on the ground floor of that.
So Vanguard is quickly approaching its 50-year anniversary, which is pretty remarkable. And I've personally always been a fan of Vanguard because it is hyper-focused on doing what's best for clients. And it actually has a unique structure in terms of the way it runs its business. It distributes profits to clients in the form of lower fees, which is pretty unique. Would you talk to us about the Vanguard story and how it has evolved over the last half century?
Yeah, thank you for the kind words. It is very unique. And sometimes the best way to describe it is some people are familiar with a mutual insurance company where the policy owners own the economics of the firm. And so Jack Bogle, after being at Wellington for most of his career, he wanted to start an organization that was kind of owned by its investors. And what that means is there's many ways you can set up your firm. You can be a private partnership where the partners share in the economics. You can be a public entity where you have public shareholders. Vanguard was set up to be owned by its investors. And I think what that really does is it aligns everyone's incentives to the client. And so everything we do here at Vanguard is client-focused, client-centric. because the clients are our owners. We're not trying to, you know, juggle many counterparties and stakeholders in that equation. We just work for the client, and it's been a, you know, unbelievable recipe starting out almost 50 years ago at zero and, you know, coming in on approaching $9 trillion.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, Vanguard is a pioneer in the industry, and, you know, $9 trillion, that's an insane amount of dollars. And that I believe that's been attracted, or Vanguard has attracted that capital because it is so focused on doing what's best for clients and for investors, which I think is, you know, unfortunately unique in our industry. Would you talk about some of the core tenets of the firm?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Alex, as you described it. I think the investing public is pretty smart. They're well-educated. And they end up following eventually to where they feel they're well served. And so firms like yourself at Evo and Vanguard, I think the gravitation of sophistication will find the right home. And so our core tenet, our mission is pretty simple, and it's take a stand for all investors and give them the best chance of investment success. And so everything we do there is laser focused on, you know, what are the best things we can do to generate client outcomes for our investors? And I think that myopic focus of, you know, just client-centric, what is in their best interest, is the reason why we've grown from zero to $9 trillion. And a lot of that growth actually has been in the last 25 years. So I joined in 97, and $300 billion is a lot, you know, zero to $300 billion in our first 25 years, but $300 billion to $9 trillion in the last 25 years is just incredible. Big credit to, you know, Jack Bogle, founded Vanguard, but his successors, Jack Brennan, Bill McNabb, and Tim Buckley, they all planted the seeds to really democratize Vanguard, right? Vanguard was at $300 billion large, but certainly many of the things that allowed Vanguard to be scalable were started by Jack Brennan, Bill McNabb, and Tim Buckley.
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel, or I guess incorrectly believe, that Vanguard is just an index provider. You do so much more than that. As you mentioned, the focus is on net outcomes for investors, thinking of the fees, thinking of taxes and other expenses. Would you talk about the expansion of Vanguard over the years into a lot of different areas besides just index investing?
Yeah, well, it is a good point, because I think our brand, if you were to do a brand survey or ask the average person on the street, they would say indexing or low cost. But history be told, Vanguard started as an actively managed shop. Indexing came later, and we're still one of the largest actively managed shops in the world. We have of that $9 trillion, $1.6 trillion is in active investments, both on the equity side, the taxable fixed income side, the tax-exempt fixed income side, and money markets. And so you mentioned earlier in my bio about private equity, I helped Vanguard launch private equity. And so that's not low cost, right? So we really think the narrative has to get changed back to net outcomes. And what I mean by that is if you find a asset class or a manager, but that manager is only willing to work for 80 basis points, or that manager is only willing to work for, you know, 150 basis points and 18% carry, but you believe that net of all of those fees, it adds to client outcomes, that's something we'll do every day. And so I think the low cost has gotten a little bit hijacked. And what I mean by that is now you're seeing what are known as loss leaders, where competitors are having low costs where Vanguard is, but leaving the rest of their portfolio at a medium to high cost. You're also seeing a lot of what we call freemium, right? Many of your listeners will know what a freemium is you give it away, you get them on the platform. So you give it away for free, for zero, and then you look to monetize the client elsewhere. And so I think this definition of low cost has to really come with context. And that is really that costs are important, but it's only one part of the equation. You have gross outcomes, like gross outcomes, less costs equal net outcomes. And I think the conversation now has to go back to net outcomes, because when I look at cash flow, the last 15 years, 100% of cash flow has been into the lowest cost quartile. And so people are just not even given any consideration to high outcome active strategies that actually would have positive net outcomes. It's just everything is just being sorted on the lowest cost.
Yeah. And sometimes higher cost is worth it because you're getting something that you can't get with lower cost. That's the whole point, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And you have to ask yourself, why would someone give something away for free? That's not normally a business model or a P&L that's sustainable. So you have to kind of ask yourself a question if, you know, if someone is giving something away for free, or they may have three or four portfolios that are lower in cost, but the rest of the book is higher in cost. You know, again, back to incentives, is that a partnership you want to partner with? Or do you understand that they're just maybe luring you into a low-cost situation to monetize you elsewhere?
In terms of active management, what's your perspective on that area in terms of trying to outperform the index? And what do you believe contributes to reliable outperformance over time?
Yeah, we've been studying the active-passive performance derby for my entire career here. And we know most of, you know, SPIVA does a great job with it, Morningstar and others. I think the challenge is that people don't complete the whole story. And what I mean by that is, obviously, we believe in zero-sum game. It's hard to refute zero-sum game, meaning that for every buyer, there's a seller. So if I want to sell large growth or Apple, I have to find a counterparty. So I'm disposing of the asset. They're taking the asset on. Net friction, by definition, you know that more than 50% of managers are going to underperform. And so that evidence is pretty clear. It's well known. SPIVA just came out with their results. You know, it's typically 60 to 80% of managers underperform. And that should be known because of zero-sum game. The question is there similarities or commonalities that occur in that 20% that do outperform? And there we actually see that there are. If you have low cost and you're active, and you have talent and you're active, you actually see that you have a good chance to do well. So two things can be true. It can be true that 80% of active managers fail to beat the index, but 20%, there is a subgroup that is pretty persistent and pretty pervasive if you look at 5-year, 10-year, 15-year performance that can do well. And so I mentioned Vanguard's $1.6 trillion of active. Our funds collectively have added excess returns. And not just to their peer group, like we could say we have an advantage to our peer group because of low cost, but our funds collectively have outperformed the friction-free index that they're benchmarked to. So our funds, not everyone, but when we put them all together, our equity funds have added between 30 and 50 basis points, and our fixed income funds between 20 and 30 basis points. And that's on the combination of world-class talent and low costs. And I think if you keep those things in mind, world-class talent and low cost, it gives you a higher probability of being on that right side of zero-sum game.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also your scale obviously helps with the low-cost side of that equation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, an active manager would want to work with Vanguard. So I'd say a couple of things. One, we get access to the greatest active managers in the world. They want to work with Vanguard. They see that we have 50 million clients, $9 trillion. To get to be a Vanguard manager, that's certainly a really good brand enhancer for, you know, let's say a Baillie Gifford or a PrimeCap or a Wellington. And then they also know our scale. So they price their offer to us as if we were a sovereign wealth fund, not selling it to retail investors. So I think that's one of the biggest histories of Vanguard is democratizing access for the average investor. Like we're able to bring world-class investing to the average common person that would not have access if Vanguard didn't exist.
Yeah, and that obviously helps contribute to your continued growth, as you mentioned, you know, faster growth the second half of your, you know, life, the last 25 years versus the first half. So basically taking advantage of that scale to benefit clients with lower fees in more active areas.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite a flywheel effect, right? You serve your clients really well with the performance of the funds. You wrap them with either great advice that we do internally or partner with firms like yourself, Alex, where we're helping work with advisors to deliver world-class advice, service, and that leads to retention and growth, and the flywheel just turns a little bit faster.
How does Vanguard decide what to pursue from a product perspective?
Yeah, I think one thing maybe not as well known is what Vanguard's product development is mostly democratizing institutional offers or offers that really have served the test of time, but then bring them down, democratizing them for retail. And what I mean by that is some may not know that Vanguard, we get credited for inventing the index fund, but we did not. Indexing was available pre-Vanguard, pre-Jack Bogle, but it was an institutional mandate, right? You had to have hundreds of millions of dollars. It was a separately managed account. So what Vanguard has done historically is take the best of investment solutions and retailize them or democratize them. So a long history of taking proven institutional investments that have worked but weren't really able to be scaled down market. So I would say that that's the first and most important thing that we've done, and our history shows that. Even access to world-class active managers that if you wanted to go, let's say, sub $100 million, you would not get access to those same mandates. And so it's this, we really think about how do we take what is working really, really well and democratize or retailize that for the average investor.
And when you say democratize, I think you're talking about attractive fees, you're talking about access, and also there's an education component to make the average retail investor aware of these offerings. Is that right?
That's right. I would add one more to it, and that was really just what is the minimum required investment? A lot of these offerings pre-Vanguard, the minimum required investment could be a couple hundred million dollars. And now all of a sudden, you know, a teacher or a nurse or a regular investor is on the same level playing ground as a large pension or endowment and foundation with the right education, the right manager, and the right fee point.
Yeah, that's great. So Fran, I've been really looking forward to this conversation because one of my main goals for this podcast is to share observations about common oversights that I've seen from clients, investors, even financial advisors. And I'm focused on finding ways to kind of bring some of these oversights to light and to help improve outcomes for all these parties. And I feel that you, because of your role at Vanguard, have a unique perspective into the way clients think, investors think, the way financial advisors think. And also on the academic side, you have statistical evidence of what reality is. And sometimes there's a big gap between all of that. So I'd like to kind of delve into some of the topics that I think would be helpful for advisors and for investors. And why don't we start with just your perspective about this world of investing and how unique it is relative to other industries and how a lot of it can be very counterintuitive.
Yeah, we've probably done a whole 25-year library of myths and misconceptions, Alex. I would say there's probably much less known about the investment markets than known. Fortunately, I think we're on the side of not knowing the future. And we live in that world of being comfortable of not knowing the future, but there are so many different myths out there and how things work. I'll give you a couple examples. One is this definition or debate or even fight over market efficiency, like are the markets efficient, yes or no, and are they semi-efficient or strong efficient? And I think that gets lost when I ask most people what they even mean by market efficiency. So the debate rages, yet they can't even define what market efficiency is. And so maybe I'll just start there with my own definition. And sometimes I think it helps to have analogies because it takes it out of the capital markets. But the capital markets trade in an auction market. and lots of buyers and lots of sellers with bid-ask spreads. And so price moves to get buyers and sellers matched. If not, the price does not clear, and sometimes price won't clear. Sometimes you could say the market, you know, stocks stopped trading because they couldn't find that balance. And so what market efficiency means is that there's lots of participants with informed information and transparent bid-ask spreads. And so that means to me is that I know if I go buy the S&P 500 right now, we're going to get the right price, the price that's consensus price. That doesn't mean, and then you can have October of 87, where the market drops 19% the next day, or even the next minute, because new information came in. And so the analogy I like to use, and I think it's worked most often, is think about StubHub. When I was growing up, if I wanted to go to a sporting event or a concert, I would walk around the stadium and try to buy from a scalper who was selling tickets. I had no price discovery. I had no transparency. I didn't know if that was a good price or a bad price. I had no idea because I didn't have comparables. Enter StubHub, and you have an open auction market, lots of buyers and sellers. If I buy a seat in row 300, seats 2 and 3, I kind of know based on supply and demand and what is the other inventory that's out there, is that a fair price? That doesn't mean if tomorrow a storm comes along, the whole market is going to price down. Or if it's turned out that the starting quarterback is not playing, the whole market price is down. So market efficiency to me is really about, are you buying it that second based on all the information and a consensus price that makes sense? Doesn't have anything to do with the case of will indexing or active work, and people try to stretch it there. So that's one of the ones that I see is most misunderstood in the marketplace. The second would be around investor behavior. A lot of people call it irrational behavior. I actually think it's rational behavior. And what I mean by that is almost, we did a whole study looking at consumer reports, trip advisors, top doctors, top universities. And what we see in almost every other field is persistence and durability. And what that means of persistence and durability is if you are the top quartile doctor, hospital, or bottom quartile, you see very little regime switching. You don't see bottom quartile hospitals, doctors, crash tests moving to the first and vice versa. But in the capital markets, you see all kinds of random cyclicality and no patterns, right? Because I do know a lot of people think that it's better to just be contrarian or buy the worst performing asset class because it's undervalued. That doesn't work either. There's really no pattern that we see, right? People have been betting against this stock market for the last 5 years. They've been saying growth is overvalued, US is overvalued, and they've gotten their heads handed to them because they think it's going to mean revert. And so eventually trees don't grow to the sky, so you may have mean reversion, but there is no trading pattern. And we see a lot of people really getting harmed by believing patterns exist that do not exist. Putting that all together is that what that means is doing your due diligence and information, unlike finding a doctor or a university, it doesn't have all that much value in the capital markets because of the cyclicality and the randomness and the amount of skill that we can't even say is skill. It might mostly be luck.
That's one thing that I think is very different in the investment world versus the rest of the world, which is if you're a doctor and you don't have great skill, it'll be very obvious and you'll underperform persistently and eventually you'll be out of business. In you know, if you're picking stocks, that doesn't require any skill whatsoever. And there's a lot of randomness in the price because, as you mentioned, it's an efficient market. And not only do events that weren't expected to happen that influence the price, but also expectations of what the future may hold influence the price. And that can fly all over the place. And that, I think that's another unique aspect of this industry that makes it hard to consistently outperform because there is some randomness interjected in the price.
Yeah, and quite a lot of randomness. I follow all of your work. You do great stuff, Alex. And I know you talk about the roulette wheel. and how many how many spins of the roulette wheel and how the roulette wheel is, and you could get lucky for 20 spins, right? And most would probably think that that's skill. If you have 20 turns and every turn it comes up as the jackpot, and think about how many participants there are, right? One would argue that in how many people are in this field, there should be way more than one Warren Buffett, just by sheer luck. You're probably familiar with Michael Nobison, but a big fan of his, and he has the success equation, and he talks about you can really determine skill versus luck if you can lose on purpose. And I actually think that is pretty insightful, right? You probably can't lose on purpose in the roulette wheel, right? You could get lucky 20 spins in a row. And so really, if you can lose on purpose, then that is probably like high. You talked about a doctor. You could actually lose on purpose as a doctor. You probably know how to have a bad outcome. And so you'd say high degree of skill, low luck. If you look about what is the skill luck ratio, I think keeping in mind, like, can you actually intentionally lose on purpose? If the answer is yes, it's probably a lot of skill. If you can't intentionally lose on purpose, then there's probably a lot more luck than most people believe.
And I think the part about that that's really fascinating to me is if you ask the market participants how much is luck versus skill, and you ask them what their personal odds of outperforming in the future are, and you surveyed everybody, you get a lot more than 50%.
Yeah, I think you would have binary answers. The ones who have done well would say skill. The ones that have done poor would say bad luck.
That's right. And I guess there's also this perception that if I'm the average investor and I go hire a financial advisor, they should have more skill than me. And therefore, that translates into they should have a higher likelihood of outperforming in the future.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think most financial advisors, though, would be well served, you know, working on areas of portfolio construction, goals and objectives, eliminating leakage like tax leakage, eliminating behavior leakage. Because I think the average advisor has so much going on with their clients. I'm not sure if they should be doing much around portfolio management and investment management, the average one, because it's hard enough for hedge funds and high frequency traders and you know, we work with some of the best managers in the world, and they have huge 300-400 people teams, CFAs, PhDs, and they're able to squeak out, you know, 30 to 50 basis points. So now if I'm an advisor, right, and I have 200 clients or 100 clients, I'm trying to figure out their family dynamics, their goals and objectives. I just don't know if I'm on a level playing field as an advisor to make investment choices that are going to rival the professional asset management business.
Yeah. And regardless of that perspective, which I agree with, that's generally not the case. My experience is clients expect the advisors to outperform. Many of the advisors think they can outperform, whether it's what you described earlier, that when they outperform, it's skill, when they underperform, it's bad luck, that's going to turn at some point. But from a behavioral standpoint, that's generally not the landscape that I've observed.
Yeah, I do think it's changing though, Alex. I think if you look at, we opened up with case for indexing. If indexing outperforms, let's just say 70 or 80%, and then you add your advisor fee on that, let's just say it's 100 basis points, I would bet you 99.9% of advisors are not going to outperform by 100 basis points. So if you're saying your value proposition is you're going to outperform, I think you're setting your practice up for some pretty big risks. And so I do feel that the industry is moving to a more professionalized value proposition around wealth management, asset allocation, financial planning, and just, you know, letting the investments, you know, be more systematic, market cap weighted. If you want to do active, hire active managers to do bottom up for you, and really try not to be the portfolio manager and the advisor all under one umbrella.
Right. And obviously the advisors can add a lot more besides just returns, which we'll get to in a second. But before we do that, would you just talk about your observations about how clients, slash investors perceive investing and markets and the financial planning process, and maybe some of the flaws that you've observed?
Yeah. Here again, I think there is a little bit of a disconnect, because when you look at client surveys of what clients want from their advisor, performance isn't even in the top three or four positions that they list. They want service, they want communication, they want accessibility, they want their advisor to know about them and their family. And so they list, we call the human aspects a little bit more than the quantitative aspects, which is great to see. And it's probably because most clients coming to, a new advisor has probably been with an advisor before and probably was not outperforming. I think the clients understand and put value more in what I would call the service model, the wealth management, financial planning model. But the advisors, I think, are probably maybe a little bit still stuck to where they were, investment manager, portfolio manager, and taking on more and more now. I do think the shift is underway, but I do feel there's a disconnect in what advisors think clients want and actually what clients say they want from their advisor.
You touched on the behavioral aspects of investing, which can have a significant impact on outcomes over time. Would you talk about some of the ones that you've seen, challenges with the whole notion of diversification, line item risk, et cetera?
Yeah, so I think behavioral coaching would be able to cover the advisor's fee almost entirely if they did nothing else. Like, they own the four totals and they act as an emotional circuit breaker. Investing is emotional. And again, when I hear, irrational behavior, I always push back, because I think we're most of us loss averse, and we also have FOMO, right? And that's just normal behaviors of human beings. And so I always use the analogy of the global financial crisis, or you could use COVID. If you have a $2 million investor, a million in stocks, a million in bonds, just hypothetically, they're 50-50. And in the global financial crisis, they lost 50%+, right? So now they have a million in bonds. Let's say they stayed healthy at the same level, 500,000. They just lost $500,000 of wealth. And, getting them to stay rebalanced, they have to sell 250 of bonds, which held up, and putting them into equities. Given everything that's on CNBC, we're hearing that this is the big one. This is resembling 1929. It's easy now to go back and say, oh, I stayed the course. But it wasn't easy in the moment, right? And so I try to remind all the investors and advisors I talk to is there's your time horizon. And most people's time horizon is like until they expect to pass away. And your time horizon would be 20, 30, 40, 50 years versus your decision horizon. And your decision horizon could be the next minute. I just lost $500,000. I am not going to sell another 250 of bonds and putting it in stocks based on everything I'm hearing in the media. We saw the same thing with COVID, right? COVID hit fast, it dropped fast. If you turned on the news, it looked really scary if you looked at the financial news. And to get the people to stay rebalanced is crazy. But I've run all the studies that would have said if you were 50-50 and you were the advisor, were able to keep the client staying the course versus the client who went into cash, the delta between those two is 150%. If you're charging 1% as an advisor, that's 150 years of your fee. Even COVID, which was a short blip, 50-50, if you went to cash versus staying 50-50, you added 38%. So that's 38 years of 1% fee. So I would spend almost all of my time, if I were an advisor, on the behavioral coaching, the relationship management, making sure there's no behavioral leakage, no tax leakage, through things like tax loss harvesting, through things like asset location, through tax efficient rebalancing, and not really worry that much about, trying to outperform the market, which we know is very challenging.
The other part about what you just said, that, living through it, the last couple decades, during those downturns, it's not like the market drops 50% and then it bounces right back. It could be down 25% and you think, okay, now we need to rebalance. Then it goes down further and it's like, okay, now we're going to rebalance again. It goes down further. By the time it's about to turn around, the likelihood of somebody wanting to rebalance again, assuming they did it all the way down, the percentages just keep dropping. And so oftentimes they want to do the opposite. They may rebalance down and then want to sell at the lows. And you start adding all that up, and the potential value add that the advisor who's holding their hand through the process, they can help them zoom out, look at the long-term picture, is enormous.
Yeah, and a lot of times we all focus on the bear markets, and I just focused on two, but we see FOMO at the other end, right? Like I tell everyone, I was in the business, I was here at Vanguard in 1999 in the internet tech bubble, and it's still the one thing that, piece of data that always still surprises me. You were in the business too, so 5 years in a row of 20% plus returns in the stock market. That's never, in a row. So we've never had that happen before. And guess what cash flows were in 1999 and 2000? 100% into equity, none into bonds. And mostly we're in not to pick on the Janus 20s of the world, but most of them were into the Janus 20. And so you get fear on the bottom, which is natural fear, right? You touch the stove and the stove is hot, you don't touch it again. But you also have the FOMO on the other end of, I don't want to miss out. I see all of my peers all in internet tech stocks, market's up 20% in a row, it's going to keep going. And so coaching is on both ends, mostly at the extremes of the bubble area and also at the bottom area.
Right. And that speaks to the challenges of diversification. So we talked about rebalancing on the downturn and then diversifying when you got this big rally, because when you look backwards, diversification didn't help you. You would have been better off not being diversified. And eventually money flows away from diversification into concentration, into the thing that did the best, until that reversal happens. And then you're in trouble because you just took a big hit. And typically you're buying high and selling low. And that math doesn't work out well over time.
Exactly. So again, I think staying with the behavioral side of things and the emotional side of things would serve most advisors really, really well, instead of trying to pick what asset or sub-asset class is going to be the next hot one coming out.
Yeah, and then one of the big challenges in this industry is, and it feeds into this behavior of chasing returns on the upside and on the downside. And I think part of it is, when you look outside of this world, historical performance is indicative of future results. Because if you have somebody who's underperforming in their job or underperforming in sports or underperforming in whatever, it's indicative of likely underperformance in the future. Whereas the cyclicality of this industry, the way the market pricing works, oftentimes it's the opposite. And so that part of it can be extremely counterintuitive, which feeds into kind of the bad behavior that hurts results over time.
Totally agree. I just one caveat, I would say the opposite, but with no time horizon, because people have been betting against this bull market in technologies and the Magnificent Eight for the last 5 or 6 years, and they got their heads handed to them betting against the Magnificent Eight here. So just as dangerous as being a momentum investor is being contrarian, right? Because there just is no clear pattern. And I think being very aware of what the market cap is and thinking of your risk budget, that's how I would think about it, is if the global market cap is this, how much risk do I want to have away from that? Because usually the market cap is the consensus of all investors, very sophisticated, informed investors, and being significantly off from the market cap weight has really shown probably not to be a good way to manage money.
Yeah, it's also oftentimes a reference point for people to judge success or failure.
Exactly. I think it's a great starting point. It's kind of your gauge of where you're heading. It's where everybody else is invested. And if you want to bet against everyone else, if you want to bet against consensus, my only ask would make sure you do it eyes wide open and very small.
Why don't we shift to observations and advice you may have for advisors? We talked about focusing on those areas that can be controlled, like tax leakage and fees and behavioral biases of investors. So why don't we delve into that a little bit more? You started a project at Vanguard 20 plus years ago called Advisors Alpha, the value add that advisors can provide. Would you talk about the goal of that program and how it's evolved the last 20 plus years?
Yeah, sure. In 2001, we developed Vanguard's Advisors Alpha. And it really dovetails into what you and I have been talking about, Alex, is where you can add value as an advisor versus maybe where you can't. And I kind of think of it as professionalizing the advisory space, right? We talked earlier about doctors and lawyers even. A lawyer is not going to tell you that they're going to win your case for you. A doctor is not going to guarantee that, you know, they're going to be able to operate you on you and you're going to be successful. What they are going to do is say, these are the tools, these are the best outcomes that I can focus on. I can't guarantee you what's going to happen, but that's what I'm going to focus on. Advisors Alpha was all around that, meaning that outperforming a portfolio, knowing the case for indexing, how hard it is to outperform, and then tacking on your fee, I would call that a value proposition based on hope and low probability. So what we tried to do is expand that, that say, if you still want to do investment management, you know, have at it, be aware of the reference point, which is the market cap, make sure your bets and your risk budget is not too far from that, and concentrate in the other areas. I call them the service areas that have high probability of adding value. And it's not about guessing what sector, what stock, what the market's even going to do. You know factually how you can stop tax leakage. Things like asset location, tax loss harvesting, direct indexing. All of those can add value. And I would say that the advisor's alpha value add are not zero-sum game. The investment management is zero-sum game. Like if I want out of large growth or the Magnificent Eight, someone takes them on. Wealth management and behavioral coaching are all positive sum games. Like I can stop my tax leakage by holding my assets in the right asset allocation. I can rebalance in a tax efficient way. I can do tax efficient spending in a tax efficient way. All of these are not, you know, taking money from somebody else. And so these are proven strategies where you'll be able to add the fee of the advisor, more than pay for the fee. And behavioral coaching, which we already talked about, our estimate is tax leakage and behavioral coaching has added up to about 300 basis points, 3%. I would be careful when I say for advisors who are using those techniques. Just because you're an advisor, if you're not using those techniques, you could be destroying 300 to 500 basis points of value. So it's really about the framework. We outline a framework of these are the things you can do that have a high probability of adding value. We quantify the amount that that value can have. And if an advisor is following that framework, we feel very strongly that they will add their fee and add back to the client. So back to net outcomes, right? So it may cost 1%, but if it's giving the client 2 to 2.5%, the client is positive 1 to 1.5, the advisor has 1, and all parties win. So it is a positive sum game exercise. Instead of what asset management is a zero-sum game.
And one, I think, really important point in what you just described is the clients don't earn what's called the time-weighted rate of return, which is the return that you see, you know, different funds demonstrate in terms of if you look on Morningstar or what you see, you know, advertised. Clients earn the dollar return, meaning they put in so many dollars and they get so many dollars back. And with bad behavior, your dollar return could be far worse than that. And I think that's really what you're talking about in terms of trying to reduce that leakage from that dollar return versus the time-weighted return.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The time-weighted return is without cash flows, right? So if I put $100,000 in the S&P 500 on January 1st, and I add nothing, take nothing away, at the end of the year, my time-weighted return and my IRR are pretty darn close. And so the time-weighted return measures the asset class or the manager. The IRR is, you know, the Alex return or the Franz return, and that is the TWR, but it's also heavily influenced by when I go in and when I go out. If I didn't go in and go out, then the two tend to be very close. But as we know, investors have gone in and out, especially at the tops and the bottoms. I should put a plug in, though. Since 2017, we've seen behavior be very well behaved. We have the Vanguard risk speedometers where we actually look at flows. And throughout almost all of market history, you see what is known as momentum investing, buying trailing 1, 3, 5 years. Everything we were talking about, the internet tech bubble and the GFC. Around 2017, and we've had quite a few bull and bear markets in there, including COVID, we're seeing that the asset allocation and sub-asset allocations stay almost flat which means that investors are operating and advisors in a stay the course rebalancing methodology. We've been public on this for the last 6 or 7 years. We're keeping it as a hypothesis because, you know, as I said before, we don't know the future. But all I can say is something has changed, and for the better, when we look at how the asset allocation and cash flows are behaving.
That's a good thing. I hope it continues when the next big surprise happens. That momentum is nice to see. In terms of advisors alpha, I suppose it's not something that you would see every year. It can be very episodic. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We mentioned earlier in GFC adding 140%, not basis points, COVID 50. You could go years, maybe even a decade, adding, let's just say the tax alpha, the tax leakage, 20, 30 basis points, right? Underperforming your fee, maybe even. But then in these episodes of, you know, FOMO or really bad bear markets, adding a decade or two of your fee, if not more, all in one phone call, right? And so I think that's really serving as, there's a lot of evidence about coaching outside of investments. A lot of it is about not letting your coach down, right? Like imagine if you wanted to get in better shape, you can get in shape by yourself, you could join a group, or you could go with a coach. And there's a lot of research that shows that you may quit on yourself, right? No one knows if Alex doesn't wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and goes for his, you know, 5 mile run. If he's in a running club, his five other friends that are waiting for him, he doesn't want to let them down. If he has a coach who's waiting for him, he doesn't want to let them down. And so there's a lot of research that shows having someone that you've already made a pact with, like I'm your client, Alex, and you already told me that the market will drop 50% in the next 50 years. That's a pretty good bet. And when it does, you have $2 million. I'm going to call you, Fran, and you're going to really not want to do this. You're not going to want to sell the $200, but we've already gone through this drill. And it's almost like you're preparing for the storm before it does. And I now have told you I was going to do, I made a pact with you that we're going to do it. And so I think that's where the behavioral coaching really comes into play of having someone else that you've already made an agreement with that I am going to rebalance, because there are going to be another 20, 30, 40, 50% bear markets. There's going to be another melt up of 40 or 50%. And I think agreeing in advance with your advisor, you know, kind of seals that accountability of coaching. And we're seeing it play out as behavior has gotten a lot better.
I'm curious if there are common mistakes that you've seen advisors make. We talked about maybe some of the mistakes investors or clients make. Advisors are also people, and they have emotions, and they have, you know, they don't want to lose their clients. Are there mistakes that you've seen happen over time?
Yeah, I mean, the common ones are maybe failing to understand their edge. A lot of people may say, why does active management not work? And they may think that it's not a sophisticated business. It's just the opposite. It's so sophisticated to have an edge. It is so hard. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the paradox of skill research that's out there. Take me a second just to explain it. Think about if you are at a middle school swimming meet. Absolute skill of a middle school swim meet is probably not that great. Right? They're not world-class athletes. The differential between first and last place may be a full lap. And so what the paradox of skill says is that when skill is low, the variance of skill is high. When you go up the skill ladder, now you're at the top, you're in the finals of the Olympics in swimming. Absolute skill is at its max. The differential between the first and the last is also 2 or 3 decimal places of a second. And so I think what happens is that the most people in this field fail to realize that their edge, or they believe they have edge relative to the hundreds of thousands of CFAs out there doing this 24/7, the high frequency traders, the hedge funds out there. And so we trade on something we may have read or something we heard on the news that's probably been priced in weeks ago. So I think the most dangerous thing is we never stop to understand who is my counterparty, what has been priced in. It's rare that anyone of our advisors that will ever listen to this would challenge Patrick Mahomes in a betting contest over how much they could, how well they throw the ball. But we do that every day with investments. We fail to understand what is priced in by the experts. And we go forward thinking that maybe our edge is much greater than it is.
Fran, why don't we close with, this is a question that I ask all the guests. It's not an easy one. But is there one unique insight that you feel investors, and I guess you could include financial advisors as well, one unique insight that many have not heard before?
Yeah, I would say I think we're at the golden age, or you know, the most glory days of being a financial advisor. 25 years ago, I think it was around luck and hope and guesswork. And I think we've professionalized the advisory space. And with technology and AI and all the technology stack coming in, advisors are going to have a lot of time to offset the things that technology can do and be this, you know, more professional service. So I've been on record. I think it's going to be a bull market for advice going forward if done the right way under this Advisors Alpha framework. I read recently there's going to be 4 million people turning 65 a year for the next 10 years. Those people are all going to probably, it's a lot easier, in my opinion, to be in the accumulation stage than the decumulation stage. You know, there's a lot of taxes. There's how do I make sure I don't run out of money and having a spending policy. Maybe I want to leave something to my children and grandchildren. So I believe it's going to be, you know, a glorious time and one of the best markets ever to be a financial advisor and for clients of financial advisors, because I think the business is becoming much more professionalized and value in a more probable way will be created.
That's great. Fran, I appreciate you taking the time and chatting with me. And I look forward to continuing these conversations with you for years to come.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's a great pleasure. Keep up the great work. I know you guys are doing a great job at your firm as well. And it's been great knowing you for over a decade, probably.
Yes. Thank you, Fran. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit our website at insightfulinvestor.org to access past shows and learn more about our podcast. If you have questions, feel free to email us at info@insightfulinvestor.org. And if you enjoyed the discussion, please subscribe to this podcast to ensure you don't miss future episodes. And don't forget to forward today's conversation to others you think would enjoy listening. This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Evoke Advisors, their affiliates, or companies featured. Due to industry regulations, participants on this podcast are instructed not to make specific trade recommendations, nor reference past or potential profits. And listeners are reminded that securities trading, commodity trading, and alternative investments are complex and carry a risk of substantial losses. As such, they are not suitable for all investors.